Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And we're back with part two of our discussion of 1970's Let It Be. That's right, like George Harrison, we've gone home, we've written a quick diary entry, and now we're back in Savile Row, ready to discuss Let It Be once again. And the first thing I wanted to ask you, Ed, was what did you think of the sort of the overall mix of the songs in the film? Because I think one of the things that we touched upon in the first part of this discussion was that it was interesting that the songs that make it onto the album aren't necessarily featured in the main body of the film.
Yes, it's interesting that Get Back is so much focused on rehearsal, and so you hear the same songs over and over again in slightly different guises. And obviously there's a satisfaction in Get Back of kind of watching those songs take shape. But it's fair to say it can be a bit repetitive. So Michael Lindsay-Hogg was obviously keen to avoid that. He wanted to keep the songs as reveals towards the end, I suppose. For the most part, you do hear little bits of Don't Let Me Down, and you hear a little bit of I'm Your Mine.
I was interesting as well that, you know, you hear Long and Winding Road, but it's them doing like a Mickey take version of it. You know, it's Paul sort of messing around. And then it's like, okay, well, you know, it's a serious song. It's like, it always surprises me when that happens, because you must feel like this is it's a very moving song.
Yeah.
And to sort of be in the studio, you know, having a laugh with it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, is there not a part of you as the songwriter and feel like, you know, this is probably a little bit distasteful to the song? You know, do you know, I'd expect him to be a little more precious about it, but it's just like putting on a funny accent and...
Yeah, it must be.
Around.
Yeah, but it was funny to think of it in that context, because I'm sure about Long and Winding Road particularly, but Let It Be, didn't Lennon say something like, oh, are we supposed to giggle during the solo? You know, because like, oh, this is like a hymn in school.
Yeah.
And was generally thinking, you know, this whole thing is all a bit too sort of choir master for my taste, you know.
Mm.
But actually, Paul is quite happy to sort of clown around with it a bit, you know. So again, it's like, it's that narrative that persisted, was that John thought, this is rubbish. This is, you know, this is all fake and insincere. And like, you know, he's leading us like we're all singing in the church choir. But I don't get the impression Paul was being like that particularly.
You know? No, it doesn't seem that way, does it? But so what we do get, like you were saying, is a lot of jam sessions strung together.
Yeah.
as much as I would like sort of a little bit more of a balance that Get Back strikes, where you see some of the main feature songs being rehearsed and worked on, there is something that I always really enjoy about watching them cycle through some of the old standards, because I always get the impression that there's a real sort of sense of enjoyment that you can see in them, like rolling out some of those like rock and roll numbers. It's almost like you're seeing them reminisce, like to the early days of the Beatles, when you're seeing, you know, when they're playing some of those early songs.
You really see, I was really struck by how George, when they go into "You Really Got a Hold on Me," and George is really enjoying himself. You know, so this is now in Savile Row. Not that the film tells us this, but he's left the band and now rejoined.
Yes, and also like the camera pans at one point, and Billy Preston's arrived on the scene.
Oh yeah, he's just there now.
He's just one of the Beatles, and there's just no context provided for his arrival at all.
No, so I suppose the Get Back and Don't Let Me Down single was issued as the Beatles with Billy Preston.
Mm.
So I suppose people would have been aware that he performed on that. So I guess, you know, to the extent they know these are the same sessions, which I suppose they do, but, like, you know, then I suppose it's not a huge shock to see him there. But at the same time, no, you're completely right. It's just, oh, Billy Preston's there.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Fine, yeah. You know. And it means that we miss out on the line I love the most on Get Back, where John suddenly cries out, "You're giving us a lift, Bill." You know, and it really is true. Like, you know, when you listen to them playing those songs, and then there was something back in your mind, it's like, there is something missing from this dynamic, though. And then when Billy Preston arrives on the scene and starts playing, it's like, yes, that's it. This is really kicking off now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you were saying George, and his enjoyment of "You Really Got a Hold on Me." It's a great, and that song is shown in almost in full in this film, which is rare, because a lot of the time we get clips and stuff, but there are certain sort of covers they're doing or renditions they're doing where the Michael Lindsay Hogg chooses to sort of show it more in full.
Yeah, I think in particular it feels like we're seeing more of that song than the other non-Beatle rehearsals, or the sort of non-Lennon, McCartney and Harrison rehearsal songs, partly because like Billy Preston has joined them. There seems to be a sort of a vibe that they've got going, where they are performing a Smokey Robinson and the Miracles song with Billy Preston on keyboards, you know. So it's a slightly different prospect to them playing one of the old, more standard sort of 12-bar rock and roll standards, you know.
There are a few other songs as well where we see sort of, you know, these jam sessions play out for longer. I was a little bit surprised when we saw a lot of Dig It. We get a clip of that on the album. We get a good full few minutes of that song with Lennon just sort of ad-libbing like lyrics over the top. And don't get me wrong, like it's a great song to hear them jam to, but at that point in the film I was a bit like, you haven't featured Get Back once yet. Like, where has that been? Like, you know, why are we seeing so much of this song and not sort of one the key one? Especially when they arrive in Savile Row, I think it's George that says something like, you can hear him say something in the background, which is something like, of all the songs they've just practiced, Get Back was the only good one.
Right.
And it's like, well, that's dropped in this film out of nowhere. Like, if you don't have the context of the songs, like, you'd be left thinking, what song was that?
Dig It is also it's supposed to be about 20 minutes or so, that jam, and we only hear a bit of it. One of the strange things about it is that, along with Dig a Pony, it has been edited slightly from the film to the record. So Dig It has been edited in a way where, like, the on beat has shifted to the off beat, or vice versa. I presume it's not that it's a different take, because it is the take where Lennon is improvising those vocals. You know, Doris Day, Matt Busby, all that stuff. And it, on the record, it's the on beat, and on the film, it's the off beat, or perhaps the other way around. And then with Dig a Pony, it starts off with the "All I Want Is You" as an intro, and then they go into the verse, which is not the case on the record. I suppose that's a Phil Spector edit, is it?
Yeah, it's true. It must be. Yeah, I think you're right. I remember the Dig a Pony difference. I was aware of that for the first time with the release of Get Back.
Yeah, me too.
The other great thing I like about that in this film, though, that particular song, is you see John playing Dig a Pony, and clearly trying to work through the song, Paul is sort of nearby and sort of working out bass parts and trying to sort of like play along with him. They're obviously trying to work on the song together.
Mm.
Between them is Yoko reading a newspaper.
Yeah.
And you do get the sense that there's not much energy in that scene as they're trying to work through the song together. And you see him do it for like a minute or so, and then ultimately John just stops and says, "Has anyone got a fast one?" Like, yes, he's getting bored of it himself, and he's like, "Look, can we just like kick things up?"
Yeah, it's his own song.
Exactly. Yeah.
You really get a sense that going back to the familiarity of the rock and roll standards is just a good way to just lift the room and get some energy going.
You know? Yeah, and it goes back to that same thing of what they've always said. Is that when you actually got them in a room playing music together, all of the differences and tensions and stuff went away.
Yeah.
So it's probably a good way just to, like you say, lift the mood.
It's a very specific creative decision that Michael Lindsay-Hogg has made to sort of treat the songs this way and leave lots and lots on the cutting room floor, you know. It's remarkable that the footage of Paul McCartney writing Get Back just sat in a drawer for 50 years.
Yeah.
But it's almost more remarkable that at the time, Michael Lindsay-Hogg thinks to himself, like, nah, leave that on the cutting room floor. But the thing that's interesting about it is, like, while that is self-evidently just an amazing thing to watch, and he must have thought so, right, because he was in the room, and he must have thought so when he was cutting the thing together. But the decision he made must have been based on, no, I am leaving Get Back until the end. Like, that's my big
The decision he actually makes is, I'm going to leave Get Back to the end where I'm going to have it plays 2.5 times.
Yeah.
Because it starts the rooftop gig, it ends the rooftop gig, and then you hear it play again as it comes up with the end.
Yeah.
So it feels like it's the signature song of the film, which is why it's even more baffling that he couldn't just go back on that rule once and just show Paul, even without the context of what it then eventually becomes. You know, like, just having him bashing out the chords and working on it. Like, when Get Back was released, you know, sort of a common thing that you'd hear said about that whole docuseries is that it was like a masterclass in songwriting. And that's, I think that's how I view it. Like, it's really interesting. The most interesting about it is seeing how the band developed the songs into the classics that we know of them now.
Yeah.
Which makes it just so interesting to me that Michael Lindsay-Hogg didn't see the value in doing that with this footage and instead decided to show a band that are rehearsing numbers, almost like, rather than show the band as songwriters, we want to show them as a garage band. I guess it's kind of like the difference in my mind, you know. And also talking about showing the band as songwriters, I guess one of the things that is featured in this film, I think it's from a slightly different angle than what we see in Get Back, though, is George helping Ringo out with Octopus's Garden.
And to be clear, like, a literal different camera angle is what you mean, as opposed to a different take on things, you know?
It's not a different approach or different angle.
It's really nice watching that. The others were always so supportive of Ringo, you know. I think I always heard that when, to sort of encourage him to hit the high note at the end of With a Little Help from My Friends, they were all kind of standing around him around the microphone, just kind of like, you know, encouraging him along, you know. I mean, you know, Don't Pass Me By was a song that he had been writing on and off for 5 or 6 years by the time they actually recorded it, as I understand it.
But there was that early interview, isn't there, where someone, the interviewer asks Ringo if he writes songs too, and then Paul starts singing it.
And it's
years before it got released.
Yeah, of course.
Ringo, how about your songwriting? How's that coming on?
Oh, yes, I've written a good one, you see, but no one seems to want to record it.
No.
Oh, Paul may record it on a...
No.
Yes, Paul, you promised.
Okay. Paul. I was doing the tune for you to sing it.
No, I don't want to sing. You can sing
Don't
that
Pass Me
the,
By. Oh, you do.
Rhythm of Blues Song.
Yeah, Don't Pass Me By. Don't make me cry. Don't make me blue, baby. Because you know why?
I got the ice cream for you.
It's a sensation.
You wrote all those words?
Yeah, blues and all that.
He's the Dylan Thomas of Liverpool, isn't he?
An Octopus's Garden. It's nice to see that he's sort of got the idea. And he's played. The piano chords are quite basic. And George is just helping him out with it, you know, as he did with lots of songs. There are quite a few Ringo solo songs that are credited to Ringo as a writer, that George quite selflessly, not that he wrote them completely, but he certainly helped him out quite a lot in a way that really should, you know, could have said this is a co-write, you know.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he could say that about some Lennon and McCartney songs,
yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is that George is kind of like laughing and he's sort of looking off to someone else, you know, sort of off camera while Ringo's doing it. Because he seems to be, it just seems to please him a lot. You know, like, oh, isn't this great? He's doing this too, you know.
Yeah, because that's interesting to me, because I guess I found that a bit difficult to interpret that moment, because George is obviously helping Ringo with the chords of the song, and is obviously helping him constructively with writing the song. But when you see George then sort of laugh to someone off camera while Ringo's playing it, I think there's a reading of that which is like, oh, George sees this as a sort of fun, throwaway, novelty, kiddie type song. As opposed to what you're suggesting there, which is actually that it's him laughing because he's like just really pleased that Ringo is you know, working on a song, and it's really nice for him to see and be a part of.
Yeah, yeah. And that it's good as well, by the way.
Yes, yeah,
Because Octopus's Garden is a good song.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it would be, you know, I know that, I think that maybe collectively we've all kind of got past this idea that all of the Beatles sort of slightly childlike songs are bad ones, you know, because they weren't serious or worthy enough. You do see it expressed every now and again still. But, you know, Octopus's Garden is a really good song. You know? A song like that is not as popular and well-known as it is without it actually being good and well-constructed. And yes, a lot of that was to do with George, but, you know, a lot of it's to do with Ringo as well, you know.
You can't also... We often sort of contextualise what the Beatles mean to us at different times, and I don't think you can oversell the importance of a song like Octopus's Garden in introducing the Beatles to sort of young primary school kids who, like me, learned that and Yellow Submarine and Maxwell's Silver Hammer, of all songs, to sing to in class assembly. The three of those were, you know, where on the overhead projector the lyrics would go up on a screen and the whole class would, you know, the headmaster would bash them out on the piano and we all sang along to the songs, and those are the ones that we learnt to sing.
Yeah, hey kids, here's a song about a serial killer.
Yeah, but it's got a nice tune.
Yeah, oh, fair enough then. But no, yeah, exactly. I sang Octopus's Garden at school and Yellow Submarine as well, I think. You know, Obla Di Obla Da a little bit.
Oh,
well,
and yes, exactly. That was the other one, yeah, of course. Yeah, I think a lot of it was just down to which songs my headmaster was able to play on the piano.
Was he a bit like Ringo then? It's like, you know, he only knew sort of three chords.
That was it, yeah, yeah.
Was your headmaster Ringo Starr? But yeah, like George does seem to be enjoying himself quite a lot at times, you know. There's another bit I was really struck by, which I didn't remember seeing elsewhere, like in the Get Back rooftop footage, where when Kevin Harrington is kneeling in front of John with the lyric sheet, and then at one point George also kneels in front of him and does this sort of Guitar Hero pose.
I noticed that as well. I don't remember seeing that before.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that before.
I was trying to work out what he's going to do. I thought, is he trying to fix something, like a piece of equipment or a pedal or something? But no, he just kind of does it and poses in front of John a bit and then gets back up again.
He does seem to be enjoying himself. You know, he's the one who was saying, I don't want to go up on the roof, you know. But then when he gets there, he enjoys it. And also, he's the one who is played upon more in Get Back than it is here. But like when Mal has to come and turn off the amp, and then George turns it back on and keeps keeps on playing along. You know, part of that might just be sort of a natural rebellious spirit more than loving the music itself. But I think he's enjoying himself.
And I think when the film sort of comes to an end and we have the songs presented in their sort of more final, completed state, George's songs aren't in that selection.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite interesting that we see For You Blue being played and John doing like the slide guitar effect. And then there's also, we see the bit where George plays I'm Your Mind for the first time and explains it's a bit of a heavy waltz, I think is how he describes it.
Heavy waltz, yeah. He says, I don't care if you use it or not.
It's so that descending note bit in the second verse of I'm Your Mind like always gets me. I've always really liked that song for how he's arranged it on guitar. But it is interesting to me that those songs are seen as being separate from the real Beatles songs. You know, if we look at this as at the end of the film, what we get is as we head into like sort of the concluding scenes of the film, essentially the three songs that they can't play out on the rooftop, which are Long Winding Road, Let It Be, and Two of Us.
Yes.
And then we have the rooftop gig.
So actually those three songs were, as we know from Get Back, were actually shot the day after the rooftop gig.
That's right, yes.
They did the rooftop, came back and did those songs. And I think they're just quite keen to get the thing done.
Yes. So I guess at that point they weren't clear on the George songs being part of the what would eventually become the album.
No, I suppose not. So For You Blue, they've been filmed doing that. I'm Your Mind, so the whole reason that George and Paul and Ringo got together in January 1970, the last ever Beatles recording, well, until the 90s, the first Threatles recording session, to record I'm Your Mind properly, which they hadn't done, was specifically because it was in the film and was going to be needed for the soundtrack album. So in order that it was actually represented on the album because it was going to appear in the film.
It's interesting that despite those songs being nearly completed, as we see in this film, they're not deemed to be important enough to be considered as the main songs that the band then capture in a more sort of completed state.
Yes, okay, yeah. Yeah, because they are very... Those three songs that they're performing downstairs the day after the rooftop performance that we see in the film just before the rooftop performance are being very specifically performed and shot almost as music videos in a way.
Yeah, you know? I'm thinking of Paul looking directly down the camera at Let It Be, like that famous footage of him looking all doughy eyed.
Yeah. And Long and Winding Road is kind of the same thing as well, you know. Two of Us as well, the way that is shot is Paul is kind of front and center. Because I think I mentioned in part one of this episode that John had a complaint that this whole thing was being framed around Paul. And I said, actually, there are places where I can see what he means. And this is what I'm talking about. So obviously, Let It Be and Long and Winding Road are essentially being shot. You know, a way you could think of it is that these are being shot as a Paul McCartney music video where he's got musicians playing with him, you know. But I mean, to be fair, there is a piano-led song. That's the kind of obvious way to film it. But more interesting is the way that Two of Us is filmed.
Yes, because that
is also like a music video. Because it's Paul who is looking not quite straight into the camera, but he is kind of slightly off to one side, and the whole group is being framed in one shot, playing the thing at once.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see John's complaint there. But again, like, these are Paul's songs. You know, if your complaint is this is all being framed around Paul, write more songs.
you know? Exactly. Well, quite. We should probably point out that, in case anyone listening isn't aware, that Michael Lindsay-Hogg, having directed this film, had previously directed Beatles music videos.
Of course.
Sometimes refer to them as the first music videos.
Right, yeah.
So he had previously directed the Paperback Writer and Rain videos, and also was responsible for Hey Jude and Revolution.
Yep.
And also, after Let It Be, went on to direct The Two of Us.
Quite right.
The Other Two of Us.
Yeah.
The film that we covered in our very first episode of this podcast, back in season one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting that I guess having had history of filming actual music videos for the band, there is a clear division in this film where there is a segment begins of, like you say, what is essentially a music video versions of these songs.
Yeah.
And they are just capturing live performances, but you can really tell that there is instinctively a clear difference in style as to how the rest of the film is shot.
Yeah, and also what's happening is they're just done in a row.
Yes.
Know, which and kind of the last third of the film is kind of song. I mean, I know the whole thing is really songs being performed, but it is punctuated a bit by dialogue and conversation, and also just short snippets of rehearsal of different things. But when it gets to the point of we are now just seeing entire songs being performed start to finish, one after the other, without a break in between, it does lose a bit of pace at that point. You know,
yes,
it makes it drag a bit. I mean, you know, the great songs, I like watching them, you know, and that is kind of what the film is for, is just to show the songs, really.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
so it makes sense. But you know, those three in a row, it was a bit like in Give My Regards to Broad Street when they made that kind of editing choice to have the band perform, was it two, yes, maybe even three,
I think,
songs
it was
in
three
a row.
Songs it was in, like, a row,
him and Rockpile. Yeah, you know, one of them was Not Such a, what's it called? Not Such a Bad Boy No
Yes,
More.
That's right.
No More, No More, whatever. So, yeah, whatever it's called. Yeah, and it completely takes, you know, all the pace out of
it. It feels like it's padding.
Yeah,
you
know,
like the stories, the point in the script is Paul goes to rehearse with his band, and they realise that the film is coming in 20 minutes shorter than it needs to. So it's like, well, he needs to rehearse for a bit longer then, doesn't he? You know, and they just play three songs in full.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Speaking of films with no narrative.
the other thing about those particular performances as well, and I think throughout this film, is that they are slightly different takes to the ones that I'm used to listening to.
Yes.
And I think that I'm not one of those fans that is able to say, I recognise take 7 of this song versus take 3 of it, and, you know, has Spotify playlists of them all lined up one by one next to each other, so I can point out exactly where they differ.
Yeah.
But it does, in many ways, it was actually quite refreshing watching this film as someone who doesn't do that, to hear, like, oh, that was sung slightly differently, or there was a little bit of a different ad-lib here or there,
yes,
and the guitar part slightly different there and stuff.
Yeah.
In a way that I also don't really remember hearing in Get Back.
Yeah, I think Get Back is slightly different in that you're hearing so many different versions and so many rehearsal takes that there is a kind of magic. They don't play a kind of magic by Queen, that would matter. but there is a kind of magic in when they do finally hit, like, the take,
yes,
the one that you know.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah.
It's instantly recognisable to your ears. Because yeah, I mean, I'm like you in that, no, I can't identify, oh, that's take 7. But I do know the take.
Yes, I agree, yeah. One.
And all the little ad-libs are completely hardwired into me, you know. So as soon as that kicks off, or maybe just as soon as they start singing,
yeah,
then I kind of know that's the one. Yeah.
So, but that was why it was really good hearing the songs in this one. Even the music video version of Two of Us, if we're allowed to call it that,
yeah,
is the song in its complete form.
Yeah.
And there are differences in that than I recognised from the, you know, the album version, as it were. And I thought, you know, it's just great hearing sort of a different take or different rehearsal. It's almost like hearing them play, you know, those songs live and then getting to appreciate different things about them.
Yeah. One of the nice things about Two of Us is, by the way, like, this being the last day of filming, I think it's the last day of filming, but certainly it's the day after the rooftop concert.
Mm.
And I think probably most of them just want to get in there, get these things recorded and go home.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, not that, you know, oh, we all hate each other and we don't want to be around each other anymore. I don't think it's quite that. But it is, you know, we want to be done with this project. So let's get proper definitive takes of these three songs. And then it's over and it's all in the can, and then we can do whatever we want to do with it. Given that fact, I find it really, really funny that at the end of Two of Us, like, when John is doing the whistling,
yeah,
and then just breaks off into just ridiculous,
yes,
like, just like, because it's right at the end,
yeah,
and there's got to be a bit of you, you know, if you're Glyn John's, just going, oh. We were so close, just so nearly done with the whole thing. Like, it was literally just the final bars of this song, the fade out, and now you're just whistling nonsense into it, and now I've got to do something with it, you know.
I mean, George Martin would have found a way past that, I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he would have sped up the whistling so that it fit the key of something else in order to slot it together with that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Talking of different versions of songs, I don't remember picking up on this in Get Back. As much, but what's really clear in this film is right at the very end, when Paul sees the police arrive on the rooftop and he starts ad-libbing over Get Back, and he's saying, you know, you're out singing on the roof again, you're gonna get yourself arrested, and it's just all of that's just really brilliant. And I think actually, you know, I know we would have seen that in Get Back, but it's almost, I guess, because like you said before, because you see so many different versions of the songs in that project, maybe they don't stand apart from each other as much, whereas in here it was really clear that, oh, you're doing a version of the song there where you're actually making fun of what's happening around you on the roof, and that's really funny to me.
And I like, one of the nice things also is just hearing the original versions of some of the ad-lib conversations, like I dig a pygmy,
Charles Hawtrey,
which is not an intro to Dig a Pony, but was actually just, well, maybe it was, but anyway, it was just a thing that he said randomly, and then they tacked it on at the start of the thing. You know, it's all that stuff's really pleasing, I think. You know, actually, I always think one of the reasons why with the Beatles we sort of tend to prize the outtakes as much as anything else is because they're just they're often very funny. So, you know, so things like on the anthology when you get slightly different versions and a bit of studio chatter. The studio chatter is always just, it's like gold dust.
Yeah, right? It is, yeah. You know? And it reminds me a little bit of when we covered the Love documentary.
Yeah.
And you get to see a little bit of what the Cirque du Soleil production is like. And there was a section in that where they actually stage like a silhouette section to what is essentially Beatles banter.
I
think there's real value in including that as part of a Beatles production because it is so key to their personality and their appeal. You're right, like anytime you can just get a snippet of some chatter between them it's always worthwhile. Going back to the rooftop gig, one of the things I was going to talk to you about was I do feel that when we had the band playing on the roof, what happens in the Let It Be film, which I think differs slightly from Get Back, is we start to see shots of the crowd gathering below on the streets, but the audio is still of the band playing. So essentially what we have is this scenario where we're listening to the songs being played and the crowd that's gathering below is effectively kind of happening almost silently.
Yeah.
I remember when I was watching the Get Back version of that, really feeling the sense of there being this sort of like hustle and bustle on the street and excitement as a crowd is gathering and realizing that it's the Beatles playing on the rooftop and there's chatter going on and, you know, there's a real build up of excitement. That sort of fell really flat for me here because I kind of feel like what you're seeing is just some people gathering. There's no change in tempo or output or anything to what you're actually hearing. It's just happening at the same time as we're hearing the band play.
I think with Get Back, so much credit has to go to the sound mixing on
That's true.
Because I remember when Get Back was announced and it specifically said it will include the rooftop concert in full. And I thought, well, how are you going to do that in a way that's satisfying? Because the rooftop concert that includes, it's sort of, three versions of one song, two versions of another one, I think. And that's a bit repetitive, isn't it? You know, and the answer is that it goes through the whole show, but also so much of it is intercut with the with the people on the streets below. The sort of narratively that carries you through the whole thing without any hitches, and the fact that it is always being, the sound is being mixed in such a way that you are aware of the volume of the sheer volume of a band playing loud electric guitars effectively in the streets, from a roof above you, you know, it communicated how loud that would have been.
Exactly that. You're absolutely right, because I think that is, you know, you're able to, when you have the technology that allows for those mixes, you can create a clear differentiation between what is being played on the roof and what is being heard at a street level.
Yeah.
And also mix in the fact that there are people talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, and you just get this sense of this sort of like growing interest and growing excitement, which is nicely played out.
Yeah.
Obviously, in Let It Be, there are still some of those vox pop interview chats with people on the street. My favourite, which is still the guy who says it's nice to get something for free in this country for a change in it, which is just brilliant.
And isn't he a vicar? One of them's a vicar. Is it the vicar who says
that? I don't know.
I really like the sort of older guy who says something along the way. He says, like, no, I really like the Beatles, actually. I think they're a cracking little crowd. it's a lovely crowd. I think he says, or something like that. It's just great. Well, he's an older guy who you would have expected to be like, oh, a bunch of bloody hippies. But actually, it's really nice observing the way this, again, like, comes across a bit better in Get Back than it does here. But it's really nice observing the way that the Beatles are now part of Britain's cultural fabric. Everyone knows who they are and has an opinion on them, good or bad.
And there's a guy who's like, is this their new record? And he's generally excited to, like, am I hearing their new record
for the first time?
Not in a sort of a Beatlemania fan kind of way, but he's like, he just seems really, really into that idea that he's hearing it for the first time.
It makes them feel so accessible in a way as well, you know. I mean, you know, London is a place where, you know, if you go and walk around the West End of London, you know, the bit of London where Savile Row is, you know, I mean, if you do it for long enough, you're going to see the odd famous person, you know, and in those sorts of areas. But Paul McCartney himself is sort of relatively accessible, I suppose, in that he does still do things like take the train in from Sussex to go to his office in London, and he will kind of walk to Soho Square and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Famously, I see a lot of people talk about having seen him or bump into him or whatever, and I always feel like you get the impression that he doesn't mind that as long as he doesn't immediately get mobbed by people asking for a photo.
Yeah,
I think I've even seen him say in an interview or something, it's like, I don't mind like people coming up to me for a chat. It's when it's actually, have you seen that footage of someone like starting to film him at a traffic light?
Yeah.
And he turns around and just spots it and he's like, no. Mm. You know, like he's not tetchy, not in a, like, he's annoyed kind of way, but it's like that is a step too far. And you can kind of see how that is a bit too step too far. Someone just filming him without actually approaching him first.
Yeah, but there's a really nice, you know, the idea that you can just be working in an office in London and then the Beatles start playing on a rooftop, you know, opposite you. And actually, there's a really nice kind of bookending in the way whereby they kind of started off playing in the Cavern, and girls who worked in offices nearby would bring their sandwiches in at lunch and watch the Beatles play at lunch, you know. And that was a thing you could do if you lived, you know, near Matthew Street, and if you worked near Matthew Street in Liverpool. And now, you know, the end of the Beatles, or the end of that chapter of the Beatles, is that a similar kind of thing. Like, we're playing here and it's quite near where you work. You can just climb out of your office window onto a roof and stand and watch the Beatles, you know. It's a nice idea. It feels like a lot of what the Beatles did, and like a lot of their story, it feels quite complete, you know.
But also accidentally complete, you know. But in a positive way, serendipitous kind of way, yes, you know. Like, exactly. It feels like it's you know, when you look at Get Back and all of the touring and throwing they do over what exactly this concert idea is going to be, and the rooftop thing is, it's a nice idea that comes at the right time, but actually it's a bit of a throwaway compromise when it comes.
Yeah.
And actually it ends up just being perfect. right? It's just such for so many reasons. It's such a wonderful way for that to be their last gig.
Yeah, and obviously in Let It Be, we haven't seen the fact that there have been negotiations and conversations going on about how are we going to end this thing. So as far as you're concerned, watching Let It Be, the entire thing has been planned the whole time to lead up to them playing on the roof.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that in 1970, the version of the story that they want to put out is this was all planned from the start.
Yeah, we know what we're doing.
One of the things also about, you know, talking about how the crowd gathering on the streets below being played out quite silently while the band are playing, I think loses some of its impact and some of its excitement. But one of the things I thought interestingly for me was that conversely, when the police start arriving on the premises and that's played silently, they start coming into the building while the band are playing Dig a Pony.
Yeah.
And because that's played silently, like that, I think gives a really effective impression of, oh, this is all going to come to a head. Like, I think it adds some tension to that moment where it's like, oh, they're going to head off, they're going to be in for a showdown with the police.
Yeah.
Because you don't get the benefit of hearing the conversations that are being had, which we now know from Get Back are actually quite polite. Like, yeah. You know, more about the admin than anything else, right?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Like, just the police arriving and clearly sort of addressing a disturbance, you feel like, oh, this is building to a moment that's going to cap off this performance.
Mm.
It's just a shame then that it doesn't.
yeah.
They end up just kind of walking away a bit.
Yeah, kind of, you know, that's what Ringo later says, that, you know, and Paul says it as well, I think, you know, let them arrest us. Really good end to the film. Yeah. That'd be great, you know. And Ringo says, oh, I hope they drag me off the drums, you know, but they didn't, you know. It's interesting that we now know that, like, the effort that went to setting up a hidden camera in the reception area and a hidden microphone in the reception area, and they have all this footage in particular of when the more senior police officer turns up, who is very British, quite officious, but also has a bit of a glint in his eye, and it's just a lovely sort of side character.
Yeah.
You know, who, if that had been a fictional thing, it would have been played by a sort of well-loved character actor.
Yes, you know, you
see that kind of thing. And
like Sam Rockwell or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the role he was born to play. You don't see him at all in this. All you see of all the effort that they have gone to set up the hidden cameras and microphone reception, you see a little bit of footage of the two junior policemen. It was called Ray Dagg and whatever the other guy was called. I think he was. They were all called Ray, weren't they? I think.
What? All the policemen?
All the police. Famously, the entire Metropolitan Police was staffed only by men named Ray at the time. It was for the first 100 years or so, and then they realised
that's not sustainable.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. For diversity, if anything else, you know. Anyway, they you see them just kind of like talking to each other a bit. You don't hear what they're saying, and it's fun. It was so much. This is in hindsight, having seen Get Back, of course, that sort of colours you're watching of the whole thing. But you think, well, that's a bit of a missed opportunity. A lot of it is you think, you know, it's a big part of you thinks, like Michael Lindsay Hogg, like you made all this effort and then you used so little of this in the end, you know. But then he had a tough job, Michael Lindsay Hogg.
Yeah.
And by the way, he did a good job.
Of course.
In terms of the brief he was given.
I think that is something that's worth addressing as well, in that I think he doesn't come off the best in Get Back. I think I'd even go so far as to say that in certain moments in Get Back he comes off as a little hapless. But Let It Be is a good film. Like, I think when we're talking about how it works as a project, what it's trying to do, what it's trying to convey, and trying to get over this reputation that the film has of being about the band breaking up, putting all of that to one side, he's captured a lot of footage very well, and that rooftop gig is actually captured better than he'd expect it to, given the circumstances and the environment in which he was trying to to film it.
Yeah, yeah.
So no, it's a successful project, and he probably doesn't get enough credit for that.
No, very
just,
true.
Just because Peter Jackson came in, and also, who's to say if Michael Lindsay Hogg was given the remit of producing an 8-hour docuseries that he wouldn't have been able to turn in something?
No, true.
You know, that shows all of this extra nuance of the situation, but he had a very limited remit to work with. You know.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And, you know, and also. You can see in Get Back that he's a bit frustrated with the lack of a specific brief to work with, and is you know sort of trying to come up with it on the fly. You know, right? What amphitheater? You know, Greece, Syria? It's Egypt. I think he's saying right, or whatever it is. Sort of trying to come up with ideas, and actually, you know, he's not really getting it back from the band. One of the nice things actually Peter Jackson did was he made. Really clear, he was very gracious about Michael Lindsay Hogg and all his promotion about the whole thing. But also the film itself, Get Back, makes very clear the techniques he employed to shoot the rooftop gig were quite innovative, because he positioned cameras on the other side of the road as well, and the buildings on the other side of the road.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And it was very, very well thought through, you know. It's very, very intricate, you know, and there were lots and lots of really good ideas went into it.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
And actually, like, you know, this footage is so iconic now, you know, and even like so much parodied, you know, just because of the clothes they were wearing and things like that, you know, it's so identifiable. And the way that Michael Lindsay Hogg shot that footage is he deserves an enormous amount of credit for having done that.
Oh, you know? One thing we haven't said yet, that this is the latest film that follows our Beatles films trope that ends on a rooftop. I mean, it's the originator of that trope.
Yeah, true.
But we need to add it to the list.
Yeah.
But that trope is a trope for a reason, and that starts with Michael Lindsay Hogg capturing that in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
One of the things that I wondered when I was watching this film is we see a fair bit of Yoko in the movie, and when we do see her, she's a little bit more of a I don't want to say unwelcome presence, but like it seems like she does seem to be more in the way in this film than we now have come to understand from Get Back. When we see her, she's either directly between Lennon and McCartney or she's sort of standing up, or sort of, you know, for want of a better word, lurking. We don't really see her necessarily. We don't see her engage with anyone at all, I don't think. I think there's one shot of her laughing at something that John says. On the whole, she just appears very, very distant throughout the whole recording sessions. I think in Get Back, we see her, you know, a little bit more engaged with other people. We see her talking to Linda. We see her knitting.
Yeah.
There's a bit more of a nicer view of her and her presence in that room, but in Let It Be, she does seem like she shouldn't belong in the film, I think. And I wonder if this film has helped to sort of perpetuate that negative reputation that Yoko has, you know, this by sort of consciously or subconsciously framing her in the way that it does. I wonder if it's helped with the overall sort of negative depictions of Yoko that have emerged since this film came out.
Yes, maybe. I think one of the things when Get Back came out, one of the first main reactions that everyone had was, everyone said that Yoko was always interfering and trying to take over the band and split them up or whatever, but she just sits there knitting most of the time, you know. And so that made me think that, Let It Be must show her interfering a lot more. And it doesn't at all. But you are right. And so, I mean, by the way, the conclusion we should draw from that is that the supposedly negative and the supposedly positive films both show her not interfering at all.
Yeah.
Probably she therefore didn't interfere at all.
Yes.
Like, that's a pretty reasonable conclusion.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But you're right.
I will say as a counterpoint to that, both of those films have been signed off by the Beatles.
Yes, very true. Of course. Yeah.
But I think it's a reasonable assumption to make. I also think that Get Back has probably had a bit more of a deliberate approach in mind in how it handles footage of Yoko,
yes,
in trying to deliberately redress the reputation that she has, but reasonably so.
Yeah, very reasonably so. But you're right to say that the way she is not depicted, but it's more the I don't know whether it's a choice, whether it's conscious or subconscious on Lindsay Hogg's part, but yes, the fact, as you rightly say, she is often shown sitting between John and Paul, you know, kind of feels symbolic.
Yes, yeah. We also know as well, as we discussed in our very first episode, that in Lindsay Hogg's later film, Two of Us, Yoko is very much depicted negatively in that film,
yes,
as a sort of interfering force in John Lennon's life that sort of prevents, ultimately prevents him and Paul, you know, reuniting or doing something creative together again.
Yes.
Now, I don't think we can say for certain that that is based on any, like you say, insider knowledge or any personal feelings that he has about Yoko at the time. That could very easily have been informed by the overall sort of media opinion of Yoko and just trying to sort of trying to conform to the same narrative that has that everyone already has at that time. But I do think it means that if Lindsay Hogg is guilty of doing that in Two of Us, then he could certainly be accused of being guilty of doing it in this film too.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, it's so it's not a so again the counterpoint to the counterpoint, mm-hmm, is if she did do a lot of interfering and Michael Lindsay Hogg wanted to show a negative depiction of her,
yeah,
then he would have showed her interfering more.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, of course.
But anyway, you know, but this is a debate that we are not going to resolve.
No, it's not. But I think what's interesting is that I think we both sort of fall into the camp of Yoko Ono for far too long has been seen as a catalyst in the breakup of the Beatles,
yeah,
and that is an unfair depiction of her.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just quite interested in whether or not how she is presented in this film sort of helped to perpetuate that in the first place.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, she's the way she is shot in this, or the way it is edited, depicts her much more. So in terms of using certain close-ups, there's particularly one in which she's very, very pale. And I think it's during the point where she and John are both very, very pale, possibly because of what they were doing the night before.
Yes, yeah, of course.
So it's not shying away from that. But yeah, I suppose that there is a way of showing a person as a kind of like a figure who is like silently watching proceedings, but doing so in a way that seems slightly oppressive. And I suppose that's probably what Let It Be is doing, deliberately or otherwise. That kind of seems to be the impression that's coming across.
Yeah, you're right. But also, again, it probably goes back to what we were saying originally, which is watching this film with the knowledge that this is a band that are about to break up means that you end up applying your own sort of narrative onto this.
Yeah.
So there can be lots of shots of Yoko in the room, not saying anything, and appearing to be a bit distant. And actually, it makes sense that people would connect the dots in the wrong way because it fits sort of a narrative view that's being sort of, you know, explored at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mean, so much of this is down to one's personal. I won't use the word prejudices because I'm not talking about sort of sexism or racism. What I mean is like one's own sort of personal prejudgments of a situation, or the ones that sort of fit how you prefer to think about things. There's nothing wrong with that. It's how all of it, we all have biases of one kind or another. As with the way that anyone consumes any work of art, really, your own biases will kind of colour the way that you interpret it. And so I suppose that with Let It Be, yes, I think it probably has contributed overall to that opinion of Yoko Ono. But in the same way, your pre-existing opinion of Yoko Ono probably colours how you think about the film Let It Be. The two things fulfil each other in a sense.
Yes, and I think, you know, one of the things that we sort of slightly touched upon right at the start was without any context given in the film itself without any title cards or narration or anything at all. As a viewer, you are almost invited to fill in the gaps yourself with your own sort of views and opinions because no one else is there doing it for you and telling you to think a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we should spin this around to a positive, because I still think, you know, there's the way to view the film negatively depicting a story, but then there's also the overall sense of the film, which I still think is a joyous one. Mm. You know, there's so much about this that we haven't touched on, like all of the lovely footage of young Heather dancing around while the band are playing. You know, so much of the band just mucking around in between takes and, you know, playing silly songs and stuff, making each other laugh. And overall, you know, the film does do that thing of, you know, at the start, it appears to be very maudlin, but by the end, it's triumphant. You know, we've heard the band back on form, back on the rooftop, knocking out the hits. It's you know, it's a great way to finish any film. So I think overall, it doesn't really deserve that reputation it has of just being about a miserable time in the band's career.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they don't seem happy necessarily, but they do seem a lot happier than you've been led to believe. You know, I think it would be really interesting if, with the success of Get Back, conversations at Apple must have been had along the lines of, well, let's remaster and re-release Let It Be. Let's have a look at that. And I suppose the conversation will have been like, it'll be an interesting counterpoint because they show very different views of how well they were getting on at the time. And actually, presumably someone at Apple has then like gone back and rewatched Let It Be and said, oh, actually, this isn't as dire as we thought.
No, exactly. Yeah,
you know. So,
and I completely agree, and I quite like how when Get Back was released, it was it was made very clear that this isn't a remake of Let It Be. This isn't Let It Be being re-edited and re-released.
Yeah, yeah.
I think for a time at least, it was being positioned as a making of Let It Be, which is apt. But also hilarious because it's like four times longer than the thing that it's showing the making of.
Right, right. Heart of Darkness, sort of like, you know, you know, 8 hours long with Apocalypse Now being depicted.
Yeah, exactly. But you're exactly right. I was thinking that earlier that the two are doing the same job.
Mm.
I think all Peter Jackson is doing is he's being given a longer running time to work with to essentially tell the same story, which is what he does. And I think possibly Let It Be probably deserves more credit for having got there first.
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, maybe what they're now thinking about re-releasing Let It Be is it actually different enough?
No, yeah, exactly.
Is there a value here in, I mean, people would buy it, obviously, because we buy anything.
Yes, we would.
They bring out, but, you know, I mean, remastering the thing would be great, but then there wouldn't be this sort of yin and yang thing of like, oh, here's, you know, this is the happy one and this is the sad one.
Yeah.
I think if you, this film that we've just watched, if you re-released it, but all digitally restored and looking and sounding wonderful, I think people's reaction would generally be, this is sort of Get Back redux.
Yeah, exactly the same. It's just shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that probably puts a bit of a cap on our discussion of Let It Be. I think we've essentially come to the conclusion that it is a very short version of Get Back. It took two full episodes to reach that conclusion, but we got there.
Yeah.
And what a way to finish the episode, but not only the episode, but the actual season. Season 4 is coming to a close. We hope you've enjoyed listening to all of the episodes, or indeed any of the episodes you may have listened to in this season, or indeed any of our previous seasons. If you have, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a 5-star rating or a review. It really helps other people to discover our podcast on their platforms, and also helps us grow a Beatles film community where you'll get to talk to each other and discuss the films and watch them and recommend these films to each other and to other people online. Also, if you have seen this film, have any thoughts about our discussion of it or anything else you might want to run past us, you can contact us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. And otherwise, that is a wrap. I think we're going to leave now. I think we're going to leave season four. See you around the clubs. Bye-bye.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the podcast and ourselves, and I hope we've passed the audition.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.